Okay, so it is my pleasure then to introduce Dr. Catherine Korsland. Katie is a research scientist here at the University of Washington and the associate director of the, the BRTC, the Behavior Research and Therapy Clinics, as we call it. Katie's been a co-investigator with Marsha Linehan on quite a number of studies and is really, lots of different words are used to describe Katie's work. Czar, guru, honcha are among those. And really, she's the adherence queen of DBT in terms of understanding not just what it means to be DBT, but also how to get there, I think, is an important thing. And sometimes she's affectionately referred to as Mini Marsha. So, with that in mind, Dr. Katie Korsland.
Well, what a lovely introduction that was. But it is true, one of the many things that my job entails is basically saying whether or not something is DBT, which can be an interesting thing to do in the land of DBT, particularly when sometimes some of the tapes that you code for adherence include Marsha. So it's been a fabulous opportunity for me to work at the University of Washington in the land of DBT and to really come to understand the importance of monitoring what it is that we actually do when we call a treatment something, and in this case, in DBT. And I've sort of had an evolution through this in that initially I was looking at sessions for adherence to DBT purely with the eye of a researcher. And over the years, my responsibilities have grown to look at the question of what is a particular treatment in terms of the implications it may have for clients and what they think they're getting, for families in trying to arrange the best care possible for someone, and in terms of researchers, how do they know if the interventions that they're evaluating are actually DBT, and more recently for other stakeholders like insurance companies and third-party payers. So while I started out very much with the eye of a researcher, the picture has changed. So what I'm going to cover in my segment here is really these issues. What exactly do we mean when we talk about treatment fidelity? What's the state-of-the-art method for measuring that in terms of DBT clinical research trials? And what are the implications to clinical practice? Why we should all care? And then to start to tell you about DBT, therapist certification, and program accreditation, our international effort to start to come to clarity about the standards for the practice of DBT. So let's start with some terminology. This work comes from that of Jennifer Walsh, Michael Addis, Kelly Kerner, and Neil Jacobson back in the 90s, helping us to understand exactly what was meant within the field of research with the ideas of treatment fidelity and treatment compliance. If you think about treatment fidelity, think of it as an umbrella term. And I say that in that the words adherence, competence, compliance all get kind of tossed around out there, and they actually have different meanings. So treatment fidelity would be sort of the larger umbrella under which many other things fit. It could include the use of therapist treatment protocols, the use of checklists, videotaping and monitoring for adherence, a collection of different methodologies. What's really interesting to me in terms of the science of clinical trial methodology is that there is no gold standard, no clearly defined set of methods that drive a researcher in one path or another. What is agreed upon is that treatment fidelity monitoring is absolutely needed. So within DBT, we know that the treatment manual, the two manuals, that's one strategy for making sure that there is fidelity in the treatments we deliver. And at the level of the community clinician, following those manuals is absolutely key. And how do you know as a community clinician, or how do you know as a client or a family member whether or not the treatment you're participating in is likely to be DBT? Well, Marcia, thankfully for us, in writing that big DBT textbook, you remember the one I'm talking about, the tome of DBT? Honestly, I have to say, every time I teach, I usually reread at least some section of it. And my book is tattered and dog-eared by now, but I always still find some new understanding that I didn't quite have before. I mean, the thing truly is somewhat miraculous, and you know I adore you, sometimes kind of reads a wee bit like stereo instructions. So thankfully for us, when she wrote the book, she included a series of checklists. And the checklists tell us the DBT therapist does X, DBT therapist does not do Y. And this is absolutely what guides us in the practice of our treatment. And this is absolutely what can guide community clinicians and those outside of a research trial to understand what they're doing. So this idea of a treatment protocol is one of the critical ways we can assess fidelity, as is the use of adherence monitoring, which I'll speak about a little bit later. This differs from treatment compliance. Compliance sometimes gets bandied about as if it is an activity of the therapist, but in point of fact, it usually refers to what the client is doing in terms of the client's engagement in a particular treatment process, their engagement of specific kinds of activities within treatment. So treatment adherence, as I was highlighting, falls underneath that category of treatment fidelity in that it is one of the strategies often used. And it really is measuring the degree to which the therapist is utilizing specific strategies and approaches as defined by the treatment manual. It's basically telling you what is prescribed in the treatment and what is proscribed in the treatment. In many systems of psychotherapy, this is a very simple thing to measure. It's a series of checklists or simple frequency counts. How often was a particular strategy used? Or was a particular strategy used insufficiently? And the insufficiency or frequency is very easy to observe. Comes straight out of the protocol-driven manual. One can think of adherence really as trying to measure a dosage of a treatment. Essentially, its equivalent is kind of like trying to get metabolites or blood levels if you were doing a drug study. Of course, as expensive as that can be, psychotherapy adherence is an entirely more complicated thing to measure. Partly, I think, because it requires that we intrude into the psychotherapy treatment room. When we code a session for adherence, it requires that we have a videotape or audio tape, although so much of human behavior is nonverbal. We have to have a tape to be able to measure against what the treatment manual says. And so it's only through this process of adherence coding do we actually know what the heck is happening inside of the box, the four walls of the therapist's office. And for most of us as therapists, that's a privacy we really hold in high regard. And for our clients, the consumers, this is really the most private act that they engage in. So just the idea of adherence monitoring is sometimes difficult for people to embrace. But in point of fact, it is absolutely critical for the purpose of clinical trials research. Because if you don't know what treatment was delivered, you have absolutely no idea what the interpretation of results are in a study. If you send therapists out to do intervention A, or intervention B, and at the end of that study, you're going to try to figure out whether or not something was actually helpful in saving people's lives, don't you think you need to know exactly what happened in that therapist's office? What if everybody supposedly doing intervention A actually went and did intervention B, or something entirely different? So adherence isn't necessarily saying that you did good therapy. It's saying, did you do therapy by the book without adding anything proscribed, even if your therapist's gut tells you to do so. And it really says, did you do enough of what the treatment developer said defines the treatment model? So without adherence, we really don't know what to make of some of these research studies. As Marcia indicated this morning, the data on which we understand the findings for DBT, thankfully, we've done a very solid job in getting our colleagues to embrace the idea of treatment monitoring. And with the exception of the two studies highlighted this morning, all of the results to date have good knowledge about adherence to the treatment manual. So we know that the outcomes that are obtained in those studies actually are related to delivery of DBT. So all of this statement about knowing what a treatment is and whether or not it's a dosage of the treatment by the manual, none of this says anything about excellence, competence, or anything else, which is sort of an interesting thing in its own right. And while the technology of treatment fidelity monitoring, adherence coding to know what intervention was actually delivered in a research study is becoming more and more the norm in research studies, is frankly becoming completely expected, though the clarity about how to measure it for a particular psychotherapy study, the adequacy of how many sessions to sample, and the acceptability of ratings, that still is a little bit unclear. In DBT, it's clear because we've made it clear. And I think that's partly because the treatment approach itself, much like the therapy focusing on a community of therapists treating a community of clients, that has permeated the research. We are pretty much a community of DBT researchers developing interventions. And so we've kind of all grown up in the field with the same like-minded values that we need to measure things, and we have moved together as a group to use the University of Washington adherence measures. So all of this is to say that we know what a treatment is, but we don't really know until we start to address things like competence about whether or not it's done with elegance or flair or skill beyond the recipe of the treatment manual. That's true for the average cognitive behavioral therapy. But I'll tell you in a moment how critical context is. So most treatment manuals, absolutely, its adherence, its frequency counts, its checklists, it's rather straightforward. But think about it. Most of those treatment manuals are the protocol-driven treatment manuals. The treatment manuals that Marcia was highlighting in her discussion this morning at the development of DBT, the treatment manuals where it clearly says, in session one, the therapist orients to the following topic, delivers didactic teaching on these points, engages in this kind of therapeutic behavior, assigns a specific homework. In session two, the therapist reviews that homework, does these specific strategies, etc. And it's very much expected and in a lockstep way, session one, do X, session two, do Y. But for all the reasons that were highlighted this morning, DBT is not a protocol-driven treatment. DBT specifically was designed as a principle-driven treatment. And a principle-driven treatment teaches you philosophy as well as strategy. And it informs you on how to make decisions yourself as to which particular strategy is likely to be required in a particular context. So if you have a treatment manual that tells you that context matters in how you deliver the treatment intervention, you can see straight away that a simple checklist or frequency count of strategies from a manual is not going to work. Because what definitionally is going to work in one session of DBT might blow up in the next. Because of the complexity of the people for whom this treatment was developed, we need the complexity and the flexibility of a way to measure whether or not the therapist is delivering that intervention. So DBT adherence coding was developed to handle the principle-driven nature of the treatment. It had to be a principle-driven model of treatment fidelity monitoring. So at the University of Washington, we have developed the DBT adherence scale, And specifically, it is a context-sensitive approach to treatment adherence. So what that essentially means is we had to build a scale that matched the same philosophy as the treatment, which seems pretty self-evident, but it has been an evolution and a journey. And I can thank all of the graduate students and postdocs and research scientists that came before me in helping to get this into a clear methodology. And I can also thank Marcia dearly, because even when she wrote those checklists in the treatment manual, in the tome, there was already context expected. It was already clear from the beginning that a principle-driven treatment needed a system of measurement of adherence that would allow for that and not inadvertently pigeonhole someone to make frequency counts as a solo approach to ratings. So the DBT adherence scale is composed of 66 items that fall across 12 different subscales. And what's sort of interesting about these items is they, of course, come straight out of the DBT treatment manual, as most adherence scales do. It would be a problem, if you think about it, if your adherence scale didn't match your treatment manual. And yet, if you look in the literature about some of the adherence scales and the psychotherapies that they purport to measure, it's a little surprising how little face validity there can be. I think this is partly why we are so pleased that as a community of researchers, folks have embraced using the Linehan University of Washington DBT adherence scale, because it very clearly matches the textbook. And it's clearly problematic when other folks, other than the treatment developer, develop a measuring system if they do stray away from the treatment manual. So this matches what we know about DBT from its treatment manual. And the specific items are all based on DBT philosophy. They come straight out of the DBT text. And it's applicable to both individual therapy sessions, the group skills therapy sessions, and it has principles that apply directly to consultation team as well as coaching, be it by telephone or from milieu approaches. Being flexible, comprehensive, and principle-driven gives it the flexibility necessary to apply to all of these settings. That flexibility is also seen in the approach to rating, which directs the adherence rater to first look for whether or not a specific strategy from the manual is needed. Was a strategy needed? And if so, was it present? And if it was, in fact, present, was it done with a degree of sufficiency for the context of that session? If a strategy is needed but it's not there, the next question one has to ask is, just how egregious was it that that particular strategy was absent? You can see right away the complexity of this particular coding methodology. Granted, no more complex than the treatment itself, but it's not something that can be done with the ease that many other treatments can, where it's, again, a simple checklist and frequency count. And for some, it's scared them away from utilizing this approach to measuring DBT treatment adherence. And unfortunately, it's caused some folks outside of the closer-knit DBT research community to want to develop their own measures of fidelity. So I caution you as consumers as well as producers of the research literature to check and see about the studies you're reading and the studies that you're doing. Are you measuring DBT or are you measuring something else? So one of the things I want to highlight here is this notion of frequency, adequacy, and execution of strategies. This is the context of principle that I was speaking about. How does one know what in a given session is a sufficient dose of a particular strategy? This is all context-driven. We tried at one point to make it much more concrete. We had an urge, as I think you can understand, to make it be more behaviorally specific with very concrete anchor points. You know, in a given session, you must do this particular strategy. You must do review of the diary card in a very specific way, and this is what it would look like and give an example. It was very appealing, And we made all 66 items that concrete. We knew exactly on the scale from 0 to 5 what a 0 looked like, what a 1 looked like, all the way through. And lo and behold, wouldn't you know what happened when we went to code sessions? We were completely overfitting our scale to the sessions. We were pigeonholing what defined DBT, and it was no longer the principle-driven treatment that it is. We had basically made it into a protocol-driven treatment. And the second we did that, we realized our scale was not measuring DBT at all. We'd essentially just gone off and written some new treatment. So we had to throw that particular approach by the wayside. And then we went to the other end and went to the idea that we could go with experts purely making expert ratings. If you had a community of experts and they all watched the same DBT therapy session, surely they would all say the exact same thing. Good news, they did. So what's the problem? Why do any more measurement development? Well, we realize that we don't want DBT research to end just with a handful of people. We want more people out doing DBT research. And so we knew we needed to find some synthesis. Go figure, right? DBT. We needed to find a synthesis between purely behaviorally anchored ratings that would force you to rate a session out of adherence simply by the use of the scale. And on the other end, we couldn't just rely purely on expert gestalt ratings. So what we did is we did find synthesis, and what we have now is this principle-driven approach that includes specific anchor points, but gives the rater, who must themselves be a DBT expert, the range in applying the scale. So what does it really mean if you find out that a session you delivered was rated for adherence, or if you find out that a therapist that you might consider sending a loved one to has been coded for adherence? What does this actually mean? Well, adherence scores simply tell us the degree to which the treatment was delivered in accordance with the manual. It's purely a sample of their behavior. There's no such thing as an adherent therapist. And yet I hear this all the time. Well, so-and-so is seeking therapy with an adherent therapist. You will never find such a thing. It is always a sampling of behavior. It's a sample of the specific dyad, that therapist with that client in that moment in time. Human behavior is so complex. How could it really be any other way? And yet I hear it all the time. Different therapists seem to be more or less likely to achieve scores consistent with adherence with different kinds of clients. Some therapists appear to have the skill set to work equally well with adolescents, adults, folks with the primary problems of substance dependence, suicidal behaviors. And when I code other therapists, lo and behold, I notice that they do appear to have more of a specialty, more of an ease of doing treatment with adherence with specific populations. So it's a more complex question than we might think at first blush. So how do you go about gaining the skills yourself to measure your sessions for adherence? Or in the context of a research study, how would you find somebody who could code your sessions? Well, along the way, this too has evolved. And what we know now is that there are some prerequisites. First, people must absolutely have been trained in DBT. How you get trained in DBT is somewhat less relevant, but absolutely coders need to know the treatment. To make sophisticated decisions about context and what is required and its adequacy and sufficiency of execution clearly means the coder has to appreciate the complexity of the treatment. And it seems to be the case that if you cannot deliver the treatment yourself in accordance with adherence, the likelihood is you cannot code it correctly for whether or not it is DBT. So now what we've discovered is we can screen out a lot of people, a lot of time and effort and money, if we get them to submit their own therapy sessions for coding first. After that, folks begin a self-study approach with the adherence training manual, and they do some practice codings comparing their answers to mine. I say mine because I'm the designated gold standard for what is or what is not considered DBT. And that fairy wand went over my head probably, I think, back in 2003. And how did it get there? Well, I coded side by side with Marcia day after day after day until essentially we were one. We were synonymous with each other. So once people have had a chance to practice with the scale and check their work against mine, then they submit 5 new tapes themselves for coding. And if they match my answers, then I wave the fairy wand over their head and say, you, my friend, thankfully you've been able to join the ranks of calibrated adherence coders around the world. I'm very happy to say that we do have calibrated adherence coders around the world. We now have people who can do adherence coding here in the United States. We have people in Germany. We have people in Norway, New Zealand. We have people in Italy. It's appearing to be something that we can train people to do across a variety of different settings, both international settings, populations of application. It's proving to be very learnable and disseminable. So once people gain the skill set to do adherence coding, we have to make sure that they don't lose it. And I'll tell you, it's kind of like any other skill that you might develop. It's effortful to gain it, but boy, it's so much more effortful if you lose it and have to gain it all over again. So those who have learned to master the skill are even larger in number than those I consider currently in my ranks. And that's because demands change, requirements change, and people don't necessarily keep up with the skill practice. So if it's something that you think you might want for one of the research studies you're developing or conducting, or something that you're interested in for clinics where DBT might be in practice, once somebody learns how to be a coder, they need to maintain the skill or they will lose it. It is definitely a use it or lose it skill. So we have to periodically do calibration tests and make sure that we don't lose people with regard to reliability. So why should you care? If you're a researcher, you probably already do care, and I'm preaching to the choir. You know what it means in terms of treatment research. But if you're somebody who's in clinical practice, or maybe you're somebody who is more interested on the financial end of things, why should you care about whether or not a therapist is actually doing a treatment by the book? Well, I'll tell you, there's a few reasons. First is just quality assurance. We want to make sure that people we care about are actually getting treatment that has been shown to be effective. I mean, I think that's kind of clear no matter what the particular problem you have in your life. You want to get the best. You want to have the best quality care and the treatment that actually has evidence behind it that it works. But that's sort of in the immediate context. In the larger context, think about what happens if something loses its reputation. Things start to get watered down. DBT, as we were hearing this morning, has generated so much hope for so many. Lives have improved. Imagine that you're in a community where people have tried DBT and they haven't achieved those outcomes we've been hearing about. Oh, I tried DBT. It didn't work. There's no hope for me. And then think about the possibility that maybe they never really got DBT. I think it's sad enough to think that hope could be lost if an effective treatment didn't work for that person, because we know the treatment still needs to improve. That would be sad enough, but imagine how sad it would be if the treatment didn't work and you never really got it. And that's what we're really trying to guard against. It's not that we've got some proprietary attachment to being the only people in the world that can control DBT. Believe me, we are a small organization. I would desperately love to work myself out of a job in terms of DBT adherence coding and fidelity monitoring. I would love for it to be in the hands of other folks. But right now, we don't have enough people to care about it or to monitor it. And so I have to be the champion of that particular cause, because I think it's really just very frightening to think about how many people might kill themselves thinking that they have no hope simply because the treatment got watered down and that they no longer really have any expectation that things could be different. So that's really what's most important to me, and that's what led us to dialectical behavior therapy, therapist certification, and program accreditation. This is an international effort to make sure that the standards, as articulated by Marsha Linehan, developer of the treatment, are actually formulated in a way and disseminated in a way, and that there is an evaluation process for certifying and accrediting people to actually do DBT with fidelity to the model, the way it's been shown to be effective in research. I think this is an incredibly important thing. And right now, we're sort of in danger. Everyone knows that some way to measure whether or not it's DBT is needed. It is a difficult process to create, and it's a difficult process to establish in a timely way, and the time is slipping by. This was started for us because stakeholders contacted us and said, we need to know. We are seeking treatment. How do I know if therapist X in community Y is actually doing DBT? I've heard that they had training, but I don't really know if they're any good. And they'd call us, understandably. And we couldn't answer them. All we could say is, please ask them how they got their training and evaluate the best you can. Or we'd get people calling about their family, saying, I'm desperate to get my daughter, my wife, the best care possible. Who should I send them to? Insurance companies. They were calling and asking, how do I know whether or not to pay full fee for these services? Organizations were asking us. And then, not too long after we had those questions, we got a different series of phone calls that were more frightening. People saying that if we didn't step to, that they were going to develop certification and accreditation standards. I don't know about you, but I find it a little frightening the idea that somebody other than the treatment developer would dictate what is the treatment when it moves out into the community. I think it's a fright that we had to face head on earlier when it came to research studies, that other researchers might develop the criteria to define DBT. But the idea now that into clinical practice, that folks were going to say what DBT was when we have the treatment developer alive and well, I think would be a different situation if that wasn't the case. And so we realized we needed to do something, that we needed to protect the stakeholders' interests. We needed to provide information in terms of the credentials of therapists with respect to DBT. We needed to help the insurance companies and other payers know about effective, efficient, and cost-efficient care. And for the professionals themselves who go the extra mile, who get the training that's necessary, who get the supervised practice and truly are striving to practice with fidelity to the model, we needed a way to recognize them so that they could be set aside as truly experts of a treatment practice. You know, medicine, they're so far ahead of us compared to psychotherapy. They have clarity around board standards, and they have clarity around specific kinds of interventions about who is considered an appropriate practitioner of a particular activity. Psychotherapy is kind of behind the times. We basically say if you are educated and if you have a license and a general scope of practice, that that ought to be sufficient, when the emerging research on fidelity says that if you practice with fidelity monitoring, your outcomes are better. This is relatively new news because nobody had even thought about monitoring what a therapist did inside that therapy office. But lo and behold, there's actually emerging data that tells us this is important. So in 2005, we realized that the pressures were not going to stop, and despite the fact that we truly are primarily a clinical trial, treatment, development, research clinic, and graduate student and postdoc training center, despite that being our primary mission, in 2005, Marsha convened our work group. With Marsha as the project chair and appointing me with my natural linkage to adherence coding as the project co-chair, we drafted Suzanne Witterholt, a psychiatrist from Minnesota who has been involved in DBT for many, many years, and Henry Schmidt, a former graduate student of Marsh's, Andrei Ivanov, a social work professor in New York, and Michaela Swales, our international representative from the UK, we began work on trying to articulate a system for actually measuring therapist certification behaviors and program accreditation behaviors so that we could move towards a system for certification and accreditation. We knew we needed help. We were marching into new territory. And so we fleshed out our fledgling work group with some professional advisors from the American Board of International Medicine. Daniel Duffy has been a very key helper to us in understanding how the medical boards do this kind of special proficiency credentialing, as they call it, and also some representatives from the National Organization for Competency Assurance. They basically are what I think of as an Uber adherence monitor, in that their whole organization is all about how do you accredit the organizations that accredit organizations. And armed with their information, we realized that we were going to be waiting around for a little while, but that you couldn't wait to feel confident about starting something. You just needed to get started. So with the help also of DBT therapists and practitioners as well as researchers out in the community, we got help from our colleagues at the DBT, Is It DBT group, the International Society for the Improvement and Teaching of DBT, which, just as an aside, I just think that as a name, when you're asking the question, is the practitioner doing DBT? I mean, what could be better? Is it DBT? And we came together and figured out our mission. Our mission is to develop an international and comprehensive system to certify individuals in their competency to deliver DBT effectively and to accredit programs in their ability to deliver DBT programmatically with fidelity to the model as it's been researched. For therapist certification, we know that there are some prerequisite elements, and that comes in the form of an application, that there's a professional degree and state or province or country-based license, that at the minimum of the level of somebody who has a master's degree as a psychotherapist, that people needed to have training in DBT, and that they needed to be practicing for at least a year and currently be sitting on a DBT team, that they needed to have done enough DBT, and that they have that DBT practice supervised, that they have a current mindfulness practice, given that DBT is a mindfulness-based treatment, and a letter of recommendation from colleagues and professional staff members. These are the prerequisites. This is more highly specified in many ways than a lot of other quote-unquote certifications that are available to mental health practitioners. That's because we're not looking at a quote-unquote vanity board situation. We actually care about the behavior you emit. We're less interested in whether or not you have a document to hang on your wall. Once people are approved, then we begin the evaluation phase, which includes a knowledge-based exam and submission of work samples to be coded for adherence, and an in-person oral exam and work sample where the person may be asked extemporaneously to supervise a student on a DBT case. For program accreditation, we also have a prerequisite phase, a self-study that helps to guide the team in deciding whether or not they're ready for program accreditation. They have to include a description of the modes and functions of DBT. Right now, we're focusing on programs who are delivering standard DBT, but will soon extend ourselves to look at adapted and modified programs, in which case we need to understand their theory and the supporting data for their changes. Each program will need to have at least one team member who is eligible for certification. And again, the programs need to be up and running for at least a year to be eligible. Once they move to the evaluation phase, we review program documentation, looking at data and tracking methods, and then conduct a site visit where we will interview key stakeholders and look at the physical space and documents to ensure that they actually can deliver what's required for a DBT program. So what's the relationship between treatment fidelity and this mission? Well, when you start to look at some of the key components, if you look at a certificate, which is what many folks have available to them in the mental health community, a certificate results from an educational process or knowledge-based exam. It indicates completion of a course or a series of course, and it's terminal. That's sort of the end. That's all you do. That doesn't really look like the standards for fidelity monitoring that I went over earlier. It's just a snapshot that says that you're good. Certification, on the other hand, is an evaluation process of knowledge as well as application against a defensible set of standards. And what I really mean by defensible set of standards is against what the treatment developer has articulated in the treatment manual. And it's awarded by a standard-setting organization. And the holder must continue to demonstrate the level of skill. So like treatment fidelity monitoring and adherence principles that I went over earlier, it's something that is always just a snapshot of this one moment in time, and that we have to keep demonstrating our skills. So our work group has been on a journey. Much like the development of the DBT adherence coding scale, it's been iterative. We've researched other models for developing these sorts of special proficiencies. We've developed exam processes and content, self-study guides and readiness questionnaires. We've piloted the process. And now what we're left with is identifying a home, a body to certify and accredit to actually do the fairy wand for certification and accreditation that we can do for ourselves when it comes to adherence. And that's a more difficult challenge than one might think at first blush. In the process of trying to understand what would be a good home for this, I've learned about all sorts of things, my friends. I have learned about how to certify somebody to harvest goat meat. I've gone to every length I could to find the best possible home, and it's challenging because DBT is practiced by people who have a degree in social work, nursing, medicine, psychology. The list is quite large, and it's hard to find a home that has stable enough membership to agree to certain plans, to provide exams, credentialing, etc., that is so multidisciplined. It's just hard to find. So we're still striving. We have more ideas. But so far, we've tried ideas and have learned enormously, but have yet to have this check mark in this box. So what's next? We have to keep working to find that home, to identify the body who will do this certification and accreditation according to the process that we've identified. We've got to keep refining our infrastructure to support that process, continue to pilot and refine our methods, and to begin the process of grandfathering a board. How will we actually bestow these credentials if we don't yet have a single solitary therapist who is certified? And right now, if you hear of somebody who is certified, I don't know who they are. And we need to get ready to increase the awareness of the mission. And this is a really important thing that I'm hoping everybody here can help with. Because there's such a need for this, there's starting to be competing efforts out there. And I'm a little worried that, much like my fear about watering down of treatment, there's going to be a watering down in certification. I'm very fearful that because of this urgency, someone is going to create a certificate, something that's just based on education, and act as if that certificate is the same thing as being somebody who has certification. So I want you all to know, according to Marsha Linehan as treatment developer, what the standards are so that you can be mindful of other things that might be out there and help keep folks going for the quality that we've been striving for. So what can you do? What help could you give us in our fledgling effort? Money is always nice. We could really use some cash if you have it. We've been working with a single donation for the last 5 years, and it's starting to grow thin, and we still have more work to do. We could also use talent. We could use talent to help with fundraising because we know we're going to need more money. If you have, or if you know somebody who has, computer programming skills, we could really use some help to get the infrastructure for the online web exams to be tightened up. We need help with web hosting and development. We need somebody who will champion this cause in a way that I can't. I have to champion the cause for the researchers. And I'm looking for somebody who is talented and cares and is passionate about making sure that people get treatment with fidelity. So if you are that person or you want to volunteer a friend, I'll tell you how to contact me. We need people who have skills in nonprofit management. We need people who have skills in public relations and media communication so that we can, again, make sure people know about this. And we need folks who've got skills with legal issues. In creating some of these organizations, we need people who can help us look through how we set up the language. So we are looking for your help. This is how you can find us if you would like to make a donation or if you would like to offer up your help. You can contact us at the BRTC by email, by telephone, and you can see our website. The first website is our main University of Washington Behavioral Research and Therapy Clinics site, and the lower site listed is a link that's talking about DBT certification and accreditation. So if you'd like more information, you can probably find it there. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Katie. I think we have 2 minutes if we have any questions for Katie. Anybody got any questions? Or money, she says. We have a question back here. So why not copyright the program?
Oh, I see. To try to control quality by only allowing folks to do so if they demonstrate some sort of license agreement. You know, it's a dialectical tension. When Marcia was developing DBT, that was one possibility. But on the other hand, we wanted to get the treatment out. We want to try to help improve people's lives. But I think that's a lovely idea. Something maybe we should come back around to think about again. But I can't see how it would work at this point. I mean, DBT is out there. We actually have discovered in trying to, shall we say, get a little bit more clarity and control, that DBT is like Coke.
Which Coke?
Apparently it doesn't really matter. Oh, the beverage kind, so sorry. But no, DBT is like Coke. We can't trademark it anymore. It's just another form of CBT.